This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And that was the theme from the original film soundtrack of Orphée by Jean Cocteau, 1959. Today's guest is Jeremy Reed. Good afternoon, Jeremy.
Good afternoon, William.
Thank you for coming back.
Pleasure.
I should introduce author, poet,
performer,
bon vivant,
novelist, biographer, many, many things.
Yes, indeed. And you've been on before, but today we're sort of, well, we're going to, you're going to read your own poems and perhaps talk about your own recent book of poetry, but we thought we might, talk about Derek Jarman to some extent.
Yes, most definitely.
Perhaps a bit later on. Hence perhaps the opening of Orphée, from the film by Jean Cocteau. Now, you used to, what's the word, habituate? Does that fit
habituate
the bill?
Habituate sounds correct.
Habituate
for me, yes.
The Patisserie Valerie on Old Compton Street.
Yes, which for many, many years I wrote my books in.
Exactly. Whenever I went there, it almost didn't matter what day it was or what time of day, you would be there sitting at the back, usually on your own, I think.
Yes, drinking L'Absinthe Souchon.
Right, and writing poems.
Yes, and novels and biographies. Yes, I used it very much as an extremely friendly office. The staff there were wonderful. And, of course, now it's abandoned, placed in receivership.
Yeah, it is just standing empty, isn't it?
Yes.
The last time I walked past, I thought of looking through the window and imagined that I'd still see you at the back.
Yes.
The last person in there.
Well, many other people worked in there, including Derek Jarman, who we'll be discussing later, and William Burroughs, when he was in London, early 70s, he used to go there in the afternoons, and I'm told work at a table very much almost opposite where I used to sit.
Really?
And of course, David Bowie went there when he was doing his RCA albums and recording them at Trident Studios in St. Anne's Court, which is a 5-minute walk.
Mm.
So it was used always as a culturally bohemian epicenter to Soho.
Right,
and the loss of it is astounding.
It is, isn't it? Because it did have a unique atmosphere.
Totally.
I think they sort of spoiled it a little bit when they did the false Toulouse-Lautrec murals, which goes back a bit. I think before that it was sort of... I don't know if they had murals before those, did they?
No. That's a later improvisation.
But it still had the old wooden chairs and the original furniture and the upstairs section and old-fashioned cakes, is it fair to say?
Yes, and a very specific atmosphere which was highly inducive to creativity.
Right.
And the friendliness of the waitresses, the staff who always encouraged creativity at the cafe was also an additional bonus.
Yes, and you could sit there possibly for hours without over one pot of tea.
Well, I used to have more than that. I also went there because, you know, London is hopeless for tea, and it was one of the few places that actually had Lapsang Souchong. That smoky Chinese tea is the only tea I drink.
Right.
So that was also another.
And it was proper leaf tea.
Proper leaf tea, and they used to get it just for me.
Really?
Yes, because nobody else ever wanted it or perhaps didn't know about it.
Would they have got it from the Algerian coffee stores?
Absolutely.
Just down the road?
Yes, which isn't the best Lapsang, but it's sufficient. Okay. I'm a connoisseur.
Oh, are you? Okay. Yes. Well, I buy my coffee beans at the Algerian.
Yes.
Bolivian dark roast, which is an organic bean. Uh-huh. And I've been going there a long, long time. And that is probably one of the very few places left now.
Yes.
Which still looks the way it did in whatever it was, 1947 or something.
That's right. Yes. Again, another amazing, iconic landmark of Soho.
Yeah. Yeah. I do occasionally go to the Maison Berthault.
Yes, it's a little bit too small. I did some performances there in the late 90s upstairs, but it is a highly claustrophobic space, but wonderful as well, because it still generates a great spirit of Soho in which...
And that's run by Michelle, isn't it?
Yes.
Who is an actress or actor,
right. And again, very, very wonderful cakes, service, tea. Yes, again, one of the last surviving places.
Right. So where do you go now? Where
do you go? I right now in Soho in the living room, which is in Green's Court.
Oh, okay.
It's a room and it's an extraordinary place. And yes, it's been there since the late 70s.
Okay.
And it's just about the size of this studio. They play good music.
Right.
And yes, it's the perfect writing place, wooden chairs.
Oh,
wooden
so you
tables.
Have found a substitute.
Oh, yes. Yes.
It's
just, you know, the junction of Brewer Street and what is...
Well, you don't want too many people going there, do you? It'll spoil it.
Absolutely.
It's already too late. You've let the cat out of the bag now.
Yes, I'll say
there'll be hundreds of people descending on the living room now.
It's closed down now.
Okay. So what caused the demise of the Valerie, do you think?
I think...
I mean, it has been reported. There's
obviously the infrastructure of admin.
Isn't it because they expanded, didn't they,
expanded,
It's always a mistake. It's like Cranks, which used to be on Marshall Street.
Yes.
And I think they were taken over by Guinness at one point, and then they started to open branches, well, several other branches, and then within a matter of years it had closed down completely.
All these splinter branches kill off the main hub.
Yeah.
And I think whoever took over Patisserie Valerie didn't understand its ethos, its history, its cultural values at all. In fact, quite the opposite.
Right.
Trashed it and cheapened it.
Right.
By pushing it into stations.
Oh, yes.
Into small places which don't really belong to what it stood for.
No.
And you can find those in any station or in any airport, whatever. Who needs Patisserie Valerie if you're going to a station? You don't.
No. It's not the wrong ambiance,
isn't it? Wrong ambiance, then all tea in stations is appalling anyhow.
Right. We're such elitists, aren't we?
We are. Totally.
But we were sort of, I mentioned to you Marshall Street.
Yes.
And the fact that Cranks used to be there.
Yes.
Although you're not, perhaps that wasn't on your radar at the time, maybe.
No, presumably I'm told by Bill Franks, who instructed me a great deal about my John Stephen biography, that was the first vegetarian.
That's right.
location in London.
Yeah, yeah.
And deserves to be remembered for
that. Yeah, yeah. And then opposite there was Vince, which we talked about briefly last time, a sort of legendary clothes shop.
Yes.
Which sort of preempted Carnaby Street and all of that, didn't it?
That's right, run by the physique photographer Bill Green.
Right.
Who set up Vince presumably in the late 50s, early 60s,
right,
as a complete one-off,
yeah,
extravaganza in a very low-life area of Soho at the time.
Right, yeah, yeah. And the sign, you could, up until not so long ago, you could still read the words Vince painted on the brickwork.
Yes.
When you, if you looked up, you know, completely divorced from any shop or anything.
Absolutely.
It was just sort of...
But very interesting that it remained as a ghost sign.
Yeah.
He later moved into Fubert's Place, and evidently because John Stephen was so powerful in Carnaby Street, that didn't work. And then Bill Green finally ran a tea shop called Granny's, in which he made the things served, etc. I've never been there. It was near Warren Street. Bill Franks gave me that information,
right.
Granny's.
Okay.
And Bill Green left a very interesting photograph archive, which was purchased by individuals maybe about 10 years ago. He was into early cut-up collage with his photos,
right.
Mostly male models procured from the Marshall Street bars.
Oh, right, really? Okay.
Yes, which is probably why he set up Vince in its exact proximity.
Right. Yeah, and you wrote a book, you wrote a biography of John Stephen, in fact.
Yes, the only biography of John Stephen, called The King of Carnaby Street.
Right.
As I felt he was so undervalued, neglected. Mm. And his partner at the time, Bill Franks, was still alive. And Bill was able to give me a very detailed historic account of Carnaby Street, right from its inception to the time that they left in the early 70s, when the ethos had changed.
Right. Now, we've mentioned Derek Jarman earlier.
Yes, St. Derek.
And you actually would have seen him in the Patisserie Valerie.
Yes, definitely, and around Phoenix House and in Soho generally.
Yeah.
Derek's extraordinary amalgamation of eclectic energies was almost amazing in that people often neglect his great books, let alone the films, which are complete avant-garde one-offs for this country, and at the time even more so.
Yeah.
His work as an artist, his work as stage designer for Ken Russell, etc. Derek's achievements are extraordinary.
Did you see that show recently? There's a little gallery called the Amanda Wilkinson Gallery.
And no, I missed that, sadly.
It finished possibly a week ago. I hadn't come across it before. What's that... Italian or French, I think it's an Italian delicatessen on Brewer Street.
That delicatessen is Lena's.
Lena's. Now, if you go down the alleyway next to Lena's, which leads you to Berwick Street.
That's Walker's Court, yes.
Right. Upstairs there's a gallery called the Amanda Wilkinson Gallery.
Oh, right.
And they had an exhibition of Derek Jarman's paintings. Quite late ones. They were all very black. They looked like they'd had tar on them.
And often done with some of his blood in them.
Right.
As a protest against his illness. But yes, tar. Yes, I have seen my friend John Balance from Coyle had some of the later very ebony dark tar, as you say, paintings.
Yeah.
In which Derek was obviously mapping out his coming journey.
Right. And there was... there is, in fact, a sort of an ongoing sort of... There seems to be a bit of a... Is it some anniversary or something at the moment?
It probably is, yes.
I think he died in 93, 94, something like that. But
yes.
I'm not quite sure why there's quite so much interest in him at the moment, but I'm probably just missing the obvious.
Yes,
but,
me too.
Because Rupert Everett is doing readings on Radio 4 at the moment.
Right.
A series of... I think it's every morning this week, probably finished... today, from one of his memoirs. Is it something Nature?
Yeah, it's Modern Nature.
Modern Nature.
Yes.
So Rupert Everett's been reading from that on Radio 4.
Yes, and, that's an extraordinary book.
Yeah, and then there was the exhibition, and then the National Film Theatre have shown, they recently showed a revived print or restored print of The Garden.
Right.
Which I saw for the first time, in fact, last week.
Yes.
And have you been to The Garden?
Yes, I have visited the garden a couple of times, but after Derek's death.
Right, right. And by the garden, we mean, of course, his Prospect Cottage in Dungeness.
Yes, absolutely.
Near to Dungeness.
Yes, his last outpost almost.
Yeah, yeah. And then recently we looked at The Last of England.
Yes.
What else have I seen? But tell me more about your encounters with him in the Valerie. And when would this have been, roughly?
Derek died in 93, wasn't it?
Was it?
So,
yeah, okay.
Yes, these were late 80s, right. Early 90s. I think, rather like me, Derek wrote everything by hand in the most extraordinary handwriting, so right. Our handwritings attracted each other before we spoke, because it's very rare to have handwriting. You've got a signed book with you.
I have. I brought
Derek,
it in. Yeah, which I could quickly...
In which you can see his remarkable...
Yeah, this is called At Your Own Risk,
yes.
a Saint's Testament.
That's right.
By Derek Jarman, and I actually bought this on Abe Books. They advertised it at sort of £17, mm-hmm. Because they said... The signature, they couldn't verify the signature. Mm. And so I took a chance on it. And of course, to me, it's perfectly obvious that it's by him. It says, to Gary, best wishes, Derek Jarman, Manchester, 1st of May, 92. I'll hand it over to you because you're so, you know his handwriting.
Yes, I did receive many cards and letters from Derek, and that is most certainly his very bold, ostentatious handwriting, very beautiful handwriting.
Right.
Derek was very interested in a novel I wrote called Isidore, which was about Lautrimor, a late-ish 19th century French decadent writer often attributed to incepting surrealism. And the actress Catelyn Cartridge, who was highly androgynous, wanted to play the part of Isidore Ducasse. Catelyn very sadly died 12 years ago and was in Mike Leigh's films like Naked, and she would have made the perfect Isidore Ducasse.
Oh, right.
And Derek was too ill to actually undertake the project. By that time, his health was in dissolution.
Yeah.
And as you know, his final film, Blue, was simply a saturated blue screen with a soundtrack.
Right, right.
Because he was blind at the end.
Yeah.
And amazingly, in blindness, recalled colour and wrote Chroma, a book I think you would admire very much, in which he recalls the associations of colour.
Yeah.
And each chapter is a little masterpiece. Derek's been neglected as a writer, and he really is a superb writer in his attention to detail, image, beauty. He reminds me very much of neglected British novelists like Denton Welch, Jocelyn Brooke, in their acute observation to natural detail and also the homoeroticism that all three share. But Derek's books are undervalued because there's a horrible literary clique who regard anything as anything outside their parameters as unacceptable subject matter, or authors as unacceptable, something I've encountered many times with them. And therefore, Derek's books have kind of got relegated and deserve much more attention.
Right.
He would have been a great writer if he hadn't been anything else.
Right, right.
Mm. And it's worth remembering that Derek's first book was a book of poetry called A Finger in the Fish's Mouth, an extremely scarce item now, published in 1964. It's been reprinted by Test Centre in the same number of copies as it was originally published, 700 copies. Hmm. I think Derek pulped many of them because he was embarrassed about them in later life as juvenilia. But I'm going to read a couple of them.
Yes, please, they are short
poems.
So you've got a copy with you of,
I have a copy of the
later edition. Right.
Done by Will Schutz at Test Centre, very special publisher. So I thought...
Is it illustrated by him as well? I can see green illustrations from across the studio.
But they have a delicacy to them, and of course a visual imagery to them, which you would expect from Derek. So I'm going to read Derek's.
Sure.
Death comes through mirrors. Death comes through mirrors. Is a blind man with a violin collecting grudging offerings, I ask you. Is the hat full yet, and you reply? Consider the fiery red cherubims in the blue sky, or those empty, cavernous spaces where the image scatters on the silver. No, his hat is empty. He is a young man with violets in his eyes, violets in his eyes. He is blind and sings. So you can see already the emergent, formative, beautiful visual imagery in what is essentially Juvenilia. I'm going to read one more poem by Derrick. It's called Poem for Coleridge, written in July 1964. Sitting, watching the fire, one's mind turns outwards, not to a mythical childhood, nor a village idyll, nor to hope for any foreseeable future. But I suppose, like the wandering Jew, it passes tableau. These in orange and emerald, down through the billboard promised lands, where the lights talk and offer consolation, as well as shine, shine. But chiefly the first, not being primarily occupied with lighting the way, and the city composed of promises stretches onwards into the night. So Derrick's early talent as a poet is quite considerable. Those were written probably in his early 20s.
Right. I think did he go to the Slade?
He went to the Slade, yes. Yeah. And then had a studio in Butler's Wharf after that in the 70s.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Always working without money and managing to find money from friends, patrons, whatever.
Right. I think he had two lofts on the river, didn't he?
That's right.
Because I don't know how or why, I have a very vague, distant memory of, I don't know why it came about, but yes. I did actually go to one of them.
Yes.
And you could just sort of wander in, as far as I remember.
Yes.
And there was my abiding memory is of a toilet, sort of in the middle of the room, sort of almost on a sort of dais or podium,
right,
with no walls around it.
Yes. Derrick and Phoenix House was much the same. You could just buzz and wander in. He lived in a small, very small studio above the Phoenix Theatre Bar.
Right.
And had his name on the buzzer, and if you pressed, you went in.
Right.
He was like that, so open. Yeah. The boundaries were extraordinary of sympathetic understanding of others.
Yeah.
But yes, open boundaries.
Right, right. Yeah. Have you written a book for him or dedicated
to
him?
No, I've written a few poems about Derrick, and there is one actually on the new Ginger Light CD, which has just come out, called Dungeness Blues, which I can read to you.
Sure.
Without the music. This is about Derrick when he was very ill at Dungeness, called Dungeness Blues. He stands by the track, a prescription in his hand, quartz, mica, basalt granules grooved from the sand under his Doc Martens, bumped up lymph glands, a face gone in, pointing to the bone. Alone the train late, the clouds signposting rain. Oh, if he had a date or moment of hope, round as an orange of life expectancy to recharge his aura with rainbow bands, he'd sing it as lyric, into the light, right in himself, not sick in a viral sweat, his defenses broken down by a replicating trick, 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 copied in his cells, Derrick, go home, if there's such a place, skinny in the waiting, as a tomato stick, as a tomato stick.
So that's one of your poems?
Yes.
From a collection, what's the collection called?
The collection is called Bonavada.
Right.
And it's on the new, just released Ginger Light CD, called Excess and Ruin, in which we have guests like the great singer Gavin Friday and the bass player David Jay from Bauhaus.
Right.
And me saying it really is excellent. Should be played.
So would that normally be a song as well? You perform
first,
that to music,
yes,
or do you just read to music?
I read to music.
You read to
yes.
music. Okay.
Yes, Ginger Light performances are very performed spoken word with Jerry McNee's soundtracks and Maria Christina's harp.
Right, right. I mean, poetry, did you have to sort of learn the rules for poetry, or are you just a natural wordsmith as
well? Oh, I think I started writing poetry when I was 6 or 7, so to me, I never wanted to know where it came from other than from some magical resource. And it just happens to be in you. And I've pursued a life of doing nothing but write poetry, whereas most poets are either academics, editors, or some nonsense like that.
But if you become an academic poet, do you then have to learn, you know what I mean, like it should have so many words per stanza or something, and it should, there are forms, aren't there?
Well, I imagine that's what you would teach, but of course that kills off any original impetus.
Okay.
And also it closes your life down to experience if you're dealing with students or sitting behind a desk all day.
Yeah.
What life experience or whoever do you meet?
Yeah.
So those are what I call career poets, careerists,
right,
of which the majority are.
Right.
Not my thought.
Okay, but it mentions Coleridge. I mean, Coleridge would have written in a very precise,
formulaic,
I suppose.
Yes, Derek would have been attracted to Coleridge as J.G. Ballard was because of the opium addiction and to the fact that Coleridge was a visionary.
Right.
You know, Kubla Khan, Ancient Mariner, those poems. Coleridge was a genuine visionary who got rather frozen out of spontaneity and substituted that with endless journals of philosophic insight. But the original poems are very much drug-inspired. So Derek would have read those as a young man, of course, because Coleridge was a romantic and much more interesting than Wordsworth as a person.
Right, right. Do you think that... does Jarman sound angry, do you think?
I think he was very angry about dying and certainly didn't want to die because he was still at the peak of what he was doing. And I think he would have just gone on and on and on getting better. So I think the anger is probably expressed in some of the films like The Last of England, Jubilee.
Yeah.
Certainly anger with Margaret Thatcher for all of her materialism and the dog-eats-dog philosophy, or ideology, rather. And I think that also, as you've seen in the paintings, is perhaps expressed in that thick blackening of the paintings, whereby the rage is kind of internalized into the painting as black.
Right. But do you think he was always angry, or was it just as he was approaching death that he began to rage against the...
I think, you know, he was an activist most of his life, so he carried a certain ideological anger, but I think the anger would have been an optimistic anger because he was so creative and therefore he was always reinventing himself, others and ideologies. So I don't think he would have been angry in a negative sense at all, but in a very positive sense.
Right.
Like almost everything he did was driven by a very positive, unstoppable creativity.
Right. Do you like the films?
I like some of them. The first film I saw of Derek's was Sebastian, which had an Eno soundtrack to it. The films are, of course, lyrically very beautiful, very disruptive, often difficult to assimilate the first time, and often regard watching many times.
Yeah, right.
You recently saw The Garden, which has moments of exceptional beauty in it.
Yes.
Also moments of great degradation. Derek tended to oscillate between extremes.
Yeah, yeah.
But some of the moments when he captures light on a stream or focuses on a wild flower, and he was such an authority on flowers, those lyrically redeem everything.
I suppose the achievement for me seems to be the scale of them in a way. In a way, he's taken something which normally would have been sidelined or sort of off the map. He's made them into a sort of feature-length film, which actually got shown in cinemas in the West End.
Yes.
Some of them, I think Last of England disappeared very quickly, but I think The Garden ran for a while.
That's right.
Probably at, not the Curzon, one of those West End
cinemas.
Yes,
that's right. I think the Curzon would show him. And of course, we have to remember his heroic courage in that these films were almost not budgeted.
Right.
And were done usually with the actors taking part free.
Yeah.
And with Derek finding resources for the actual film.
And the Super 8 films, did you ever see those?
I've seen some here and there.
Which he included, I think he filmed in clubs.
That's right.
I think there were people like John Mabry and Kerith Wynne Evans. So. There was a clique of filmmakers, mostly working in Super 8, as far as I know. And a lot of that footage was then incorporated into the feature films, in fact.
Yes, I think a lot of Derek's Super 8 films have now been digitized and put onto DVDs.
Yeah.
There was the angelic conversation that he did with Judy Dench and Coyle, which is very interesting.
Yeah. That was shot in Dorset, I think, on the Dorset coast.
That's right.
Yeah.
I was very friendly with Coyle, John Balance and Peter Christopherson, who were great admirers, naturally, of Derek. And yes, Derek was willing to take on those sort of things, which you think probably nobody else would have, as you say. Yeah, they are subjects that perhaps others would never have featured to that extent.
Yeah.
All part of his brilliance to be able to make a detail into a landscape.
Yes. Yes, and I think The Last of England was, it might even have been shown on Channel 4. I'm not sure. I can't remember now. I think it rolled on up at the end on the credits that, it did achieve sponsorship, you know, from either the British Film Institute or Channel 4 or something.
He did later on get BFI sponsorship.
And it's a very uncompromising film.
Yes, totally.
Whatever one might think of it aesthetically or whatever,
it is
his own film entirely.
Oh, totally. All the films are completely uncompromising, right from Sebastian all the way through.
Right.
And, of course, his actual theatre stage work, but not only for Ken Russell, but John Mabry and others like that too, has never been really focused into the greatness that it was. And, of course, obviously a lot of those sets disappear and there's no historic record of them, etc.
Right.
Outside of photographs.
Yeah.
But he was so multi-talented, so driven by creativity.
Yeah.
Of course, we mentioned also in our little talk before coming on live that he did a lot of pop videos.
Right, yes. We were going to talk about the pop video. You've selected two or three.
Yes.
Tell me a bit about those. Obviously, he must have got paid quite well for
them. Yes, I think, as he says in his journals, that's the reason he did them. I don't think he was ever a great pop enthusiast.
No.
But, of course, that provided money for his own projects.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, he was so brilliant in what he did with pop videos. I think my favourite of his pop videos is the first one we're going to play.
Okay.
Mark Almond's Tenderness is a Weakness, in which he has Mark holding a burning torch up against a backdrop of Soho dustbins.
Oh, really? Well, I can watch the video, but everyone else would just be.
Yes, the romanticism of the song.
It seems to be about 5 minutes long, which is quite unusual.
Yes, it is, but it's a very romantic song.
Was it a successful record at the time?
I think it got into the 30s, but it's a great torch achievement.
Right. Okay, well, let's listen to this. This is Mark Almond, Tenderness is a Weakness.
I hold on to my mystery. Secrets that make of me one.
Right, so that's Mark Almond, Tenderness is a Weakness. When's that date from, Jeremy?
1984. It's a track on Mark's first solo album called Vermin in Ermine.
Okay. Vermin in Ermine. Okay. He's an extraordinary voice he has, doesn't he?
Yes. To me, he is the greatest voice in pop singing without any doubt.
Right. Okay.
I've always been a massive fan.
Right. Well, we can play another track of his later. I think we've got another one lined up for later, haven't we? What's the other one we're going to
play? The other one's from the same album you have. I chose them because they're both very romantic songs.
Right.
And that is what I love about Mark, is the romantic core of each song.
Yeah. The video is very stagey. It looks like a stage
set. Very theatrical, yes.
And Jarman, of course, he did do a lot of stage scenery, didn't he?
Yes, exactly. So it comes out of that.
Exactly. And he did things for Ken Russell. And there is a sort of Mark Almond, at times his hair seems to be sort of in the shape of little horns. And it put me in mind somewhat, with the red background and the horned head, it sort of put me in mind somewhat of Kenneth Anger's films to a degree. Although I've read a couple of books on Jarman recently about the films, and he's very, very, he sort of downplays the Anger influence. He's only gets sort of mentioned very, very fleetingly, sort of almost as a footnote, which I think is a bit, perhaps a bit disingenuous, but there we are. But he also had an interest in John Dee, I think.
Yes.
Not that I know anything about John Dee.
Occult Majors.
Exactly, and which also is a bit Kenneth Anger-ish, who had this interest in the occult and so on.
And also very Ken Russell-ish.
Was it?
Remembering, of course, that Derek...
Oh, The Devils, wasn't it?
...did the production, the stage designer for The Devils.
Right.
For Ken. In fact, that's where Derek learned his art, very much through Ken Russell.
Right. Right.
But, of course, I agree with you. There is a lot of Kenneth Anger in the pigment of Derek's personality.
And the sort of non-narrative aspect to it all.
Yes, very much so.
So would you like to... I thought there was a book which you mentioned, which was either dedicated to Derek Jarman or had some reference to him in the title or whatever.
I've read Dungeness Blues, but...
Yeah, I thought there was something else. Perhaps not. But perhaps you could read something from the other tome you have with you, or something you've done recently.
Because I met Derek originally in Soho, and because I also, as an offshoot of Soho, write a lot of poems in Leicester Square in good weather, favourable weather.
Right.
And meet a lot of people like that. I want to read this poem called Writing Outside. I meet them all, anomalous strangers, aberrant, inquisitive, abnormal, drawn to me like it's Chinese characters I manipulate with ink into Zen as word partners. You've got one up on me for writing on the streets, self-exposure, a species of indulgent criminality like keyless theft. And what I lift from you is aspects of your personality, the jewel-like strands, the dirty stuff that's sweet, sweet, sweet. I do it in your face, clouds stacking up like a sugar skull over Leicester Square, moribund cirrostratus humped purple. I get my friends like that, exchange numbers, the accidental synchronicity works to advantage. The way time slows down in public and seems to create delay like thinking backwards. Sex comes into it. You don't know what's my preference only. I represent what you suppressed as arguable potential poetry. We all imagine as romantic quests, and I'm the strange attractor doing it for you with attitude you won't forget, you won't forget.
That's a manuscript poem you have there.
Yeah, written outside in Leicester Square, just as it is.
Right. Not published yet.
Not published yet, but, okay. But performed.
Really? Okay.
I use that in solo performances and with the Ginger Light.
So you perform with the Ginger Light, this musical group. Well, have you got something, coming up somewhere?
Ginger Light, we haven't got dates yet, but we'll be doing the Red Chesterton Room at Keith's House late summer, and we'll be doing Horse Hospital, which we often do.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll be doing the City Lit Theatre when that date is announced.
Oh, so you have
yes,
dates.
Yes, we're always
rolling into the future.
Active and making new material.
Right. So I should just say this is Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guest is the poet, author, biographer Jeremy Reed. And we've been talking about Derek Jarman mostly, and you've been reading your own poems.
Yes.
We could play another. What should we do now? Play another. This was another video that Derek Jarman made the film for, as it were. This is the Pet Shop Boys.
The Pet Shop Boys.
Rent. When does this date from? Do you know offhand? Or
this would be
approximately.
About probably 1990. Something like that.
Would the musicians would have presumably asked specifically for Derek Jarman to make their next video or something?
Yes.
Were the connections?
I would imagine Neil Tennant would have asked for that, yes.
Right.
To have Derek.
Yeah.
Yes, because Derek was very much a cult.
Right.
So bands wanting to be in any way cutting edge, Derek was a very good figure to have behind you.
Sure, yeah. Although, often, strangely, they're rarely credited, are they, pop videos? I mean, you very rarely you'd have to know it was by him.
Absolutely.
In order to... Anyway, let's play this. This is the Pet Shop Boys' Rent.
Dress me up, I'm your puppet.
That's another very distinctive voice. Yes. Like Mark Almond, somewhat. I mean, not like him, you know what I mean?
Another, yes, very another... distinctive, whereas Mark is much more dramatically theatrical.
Right.
Neil Tennant's voice, yes, is immediately appealable, isn't it?
Yeah,
you recognise it anywhere.
Yeah. Quite acerbic lyrics.
Yes, acerbic lyrics.
Is that
an obvious pop hit in terms of the catchy hook?
Yeah. Yes.
Destined, not complex like Mark's song, but just what it is, perfect pop.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
Whereas Mark's Tenderness of Weakness has a much more complex feel to it and a much more complex structure, which, of course, you have to be able to sing. That is perfect pop, though, the Pet Shop Boys, right? Perfect pop.
Yeah.
And, of course, Derek, of the eras in which he belonged, would have been very familiar with Piccadilly Rent Boys.
Right.
So the title alone, although that song is probably set in America, although it transposes itself in geography, so Derek would be very familiar with Rent Boys.
Right.
Referenced in that song, of course.
Sure.
It's the sugar daddy to the young guy.
Yeah, yeah. And we've chosen these, well, you've chosen these tracks because Derek Jarman did videos for each of these. And one of the other ones on your list was something by Brian Ferry. But I think we've both agreed that we're not big fans of Brian Ferry.
No, far too mainstream for this.
Yes, and he possibly doesn't fit the genre either, does he?
Other than the romantic title Windswept, it doesn't, no.
No. What, do you know the other ones he did?
He did one for the Smiths.
Oh, okay.
There is a whole list on the Derek Jarman online page.
Right.
Where
right.
people can reference probably, I think, up to about 20 at least.
Okay. Well, we can finish with a Mark Almond one eventually, which is the last Mark Almond one.
I think we're going to play one from the same album called You Have, which again is a very beautiful romantic ballad.
Right. Would you like to read another one of your poems in the meantime?
I'm going to read another of Derek's poems.
Okay.
They are so little known that I'm sure most listeners...
Is it still in print, this book? Can you still buy these?
I think this reprint may still be in print.
And what's the title of it? I can't remember.
The title of it is A Finger in the Fish's Mouth. Very few of the original copies survive. So Will Shoots at 10... Test Center reprinted, a facsimile edition. It has a silver cover, which on the original oxidized very badly, the silver foil. So most existing copies of the first edition, the cover has largely oxidized brown.
Right.
Presumably because it was quite cheaply printed by a small press.
Right.
But an original would cost you some considerable money.
Especially as he apparently, you said he destroyed quite a lot of them.
Yes.
Yeah. Would you consider them juvenilia, or do you think they stand up well?
I think they stand up very well, not only because I admire Derek a lot, but I think as poems written by a young man, and I don't think one needs to age when they were written, they seem to me to read extremely well. I'm an admirer of this book, which probably very few people have had access to, but I recommend you check Test Centre online and see if they still have copies. I'm going to read another of Derek's poems written in, he dated his poems, written in April 64. It's clearly on a visit to Venice. Cosmati plan, thanks to Michelin guidebooks of this canaletto to the sea from our island ghetto and its paternal warehouses. We could see the rain drifting in from the dead Adriatic. A bridge particularly favoured by the sunset. Even the Americans were absent, with the whole stage set for a perfect holiday swash. And the wind whispering, she's sinking at last, she's sinking. Hear the ghosts of doges with wet feet, planning a secret counterattack with two saints and illustrations by Bellini, an envoy to Canute, and to Leonardo at Milan for practical advice, watching the important preparation with Damask for this year's resurrection in a drowning city, dreaming of a Kodak summer and an important seduction by a young girl of a languid soldier with lightning behind the houses. I think that stands up.
Mm.
Like all of Derek's early poems, is so filmic, so visual, so perfectly involved with colour. You can see the immediate visual eye at work in his poetry.
There are also
some poems at the end of his book on colour, Chroma. Right. Other than that, I don't know if other poems survive, but I certainly hope they do and that we will be able to read them.
Yeah. Now, should we play the Mark Arman track now and then perhaps finish with one of your poems?
Yes, that would be lovely. We'll play You Have.
Okay. All right. What's the date of this one?
1984.
Okay. From the same
album.
Vermin Ermin.
Yes. Right, yes.
Don't think that would be shown on Top of the Pops, that particular video.
No, probably not. But the song is amazingly, beautifully romantic.
Right. And so, well, we've just about got time. We've got about 3 minutes left.
Thank you very much for having me on, William.
Well, thank you very much to Jeremy Reed for coming in and talking about Derek Jarman and picking the songs. And now, this is one of your own poems.
Yes, because Derek loved flowers, I want to dedicate this to his spirit. Huge red poppies. The first pop. A frilly red parachute puffed into shivers by breezy grammar. Unopened testicular heads glowering bluely, blackly for a week like missiles stacked in a silo. And opportunistically tweaked by light into brutalist, hairy skyscrapers, intense flamenco red ostentation. A dusty silk fist as a flower. Another day there's five I count with amazing purple centres, violet if I go down a tone, a colour shock holding me to their radiance like red excludes every other colour for happening fast. I lose it all, the sense of other things, diversity, the visions an upfront 10 feet downsized universe, all I've got with no inclusions, just 6 red poppies overspilling into a giant China red sun.
Wow, so that's that is very it conjures up the image of Prospect Cottage in a way, because I think he grew poppies.
That's right,
didn't
absolutely,
he?
Or, yes.
Outside Prospect Cottage.
Yes.
Which we've got 1 minute left. We could possibly plug that. I mean, the Dungeness, it is an extraordinary place to visit, isn't
it?
There's a shingle,
yes.
You've got the Dungeness Power Station, Prospect Cottage,
desolation.
This strange sort of miniature railway,
yes.
Which runs along the back of the of his cottage, in fact, and runs from Dungeness to Hythe, which is quite, the whole thing is quite extraordinary.
And that lowering green-grey sea there.
Yes.
And the shingle, an amazing enclave.
All right, well, thanks very much again to Jeremy Reed for coming in.
Well, thank you very much, William, for inviting me.
That's all right, and perhaps you'll come back sometime.
Yes, I would be delighted to do that.
And perhaps perform with the Ginger Light or
yes,
something.
That would be very lovely,
Excellent. All right, thank you very much.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.